And then there's just about as many people who feel like this huge tragic mistake has been made and wondering if maybe we're on the brink of total collapse as our society disintegrates. That is the nature of elections. I've seen a bunch of them up to this point in my life, and they all have that effect on those of us who are involved and vote and care and observe. And I want you to know that I am in no way, even remotely, trying to make light of political involvement. Our society, political involvement is one of the many ways in which we can express our values, our world perspective as Christians. Part of our God-given responsibility on this earth is to do whatever we can to communicate truly godly values to a world that has absolutely no moral compass whatsoever. And in our society, the political arena it's a tool for doing just that. When there are issues involved that are clearly moral in nature, it is a tremendous means by which we can express ourselves. Having said that, I have to follow it up with one additional comment. I'm not sure how this happened, but I think that certainly within my lifetime, especially as our nation has utterly rejected the concept of absolute moral standard to which all people are held accountable and have just wildly embraced the absolute defense of the personal rights of the individual, somewhere in this process, there have been times when we, as Christians, seem to have misunderstood our calling. Our calling is not, never has been, never will be, to legislate morality. You can't get there that way, any more than you can transform a life through law. Certainly, we should do whatever we can to pass laws that are consistent with what we understand to be true biblical morality and to select and elect leaders who recognize and personally and publicly submit to that morality. But if we are not able to pass the laws we want or elect the men and women that we want, then we have not failed so long as we remain faithful to raising the questions confronting our nation with the issues. Do you know what we are as Christians in any society? Now this is tricky for me to say this because you may misinterpret it. Do you know how your conscience works? Your conscience, which is built into you by your Creator, is a natural, I mean not a natural, it's a designed in awareness of moral accountability. But it gives you absolutely no ability, no strength whatsoever to fulfill what your conscience says. It just tells you there's moral right and wrong. All right, one of the roles that we serve in our society as Christians is we do that for the society around us. We have no illusions about trying to make people good. But part of what we do is to say, there is good, there is evil, there is moral right, there is moral wrong, and we say that by the way we live. Not so much by what we verbalize, but by what we illustrate with our life. And it's one of the roles that we have as God's people here on this earth. We do it by our lives, living in a way that is absolutely consistent with those moral values that are given to us by our God. And at the top of the list of those moral values given to us by our God, see, and this is another place where I think we miss sometimes, because at the top of that list is our calling to actively, aggressively love the people that God brings into our lives. During this past election, did you have contact with another person whose political views you violently objected to? Did you find yourself thinking that your calling as a Christian was to point out to them what an idiot they were in nice terms? Did you know that you had another and far higher calling? It was the calling of finding some way of communicating how deeply you cared about them as a person, no matter where they stood on the issues. Anne Lamott, a fascinating Christian writer and thinker, once said that she knows that she has formed God in her own image when He hates all the same people that she hates. I think that is one of the most remarkable, insightful statements I have ever come across. These are not the things that I most want to spend our time looking at this morning. Given the fact that we've just come through a national election and that the men and women that we as a nation have placed into leadership over us will certainly make some significant changes in the direction our nation moves in the months ahead, I want to take both this election and the role of human political leadership and place them into a biblical setting. Did you pray about the election this past week? I did. And I'm convinced that many of you did as well. Did the candidate that you voted for get elected? If he or she did, do you interpret that as meaning that God heard your prayer and answered it? If the candidates of your choice did not get elected, did you come away from the election feeling as if, in spite of your prayers, somehow Satan somehow overpowered God and flung Him to the mat and claimed the upper hand? Do you find yourself thinking that the fulfillment of God's will and His plan and purpose for our world and our nation is dependent upon the right people being placed into political power? And if the wrong people get elected, then God's program on this earth will be frustrated or sabotaged at some level. Do you believe that God's design for the ages is in some way tied to and dependent upon the will of man? Well, if any such feelings have ever crossed your mind, I want to take the rest of our time together this morning to remind us of three divine absolutes when it comes to God and those who hold positions of political power over us. The first absolute I want to share with you this morning comes to us courtesy of the second psalm. We're going to look at that psalm quickly, then I'll share the absolute that I want to start with after we've looked at the psalm. I need to keep myself focused this morning to be sure that I get us where I want us to go, but let me just say that if you ever find yourself losing perspective either on your own life personally or on the events that you see unfolding in the world around you, take a few minutes and read the first two psalms. In fact, you can probably do it in about 2 minutes. They are both remarkable and wonderful for what they share with us. The first psalm talks about the commitment that God makes to those who make it their goal to live a life of moral integrity in this world. And in just 6 verses, David paints a vivid portrait of a life that is profoundly worth living, a life of strength and beauty and fruitfulness, a life guided and protected by the very hand of God Himself. And then in the second psalm, David turns his attention from the life of the individual Christian to God's relationship with all of those who hold political power in human society. What he says is quite simply wonderful. In the first 3 verses, he captures human political leaders at their worst. He does this because if we see how God handles the worst possible situations, then we also know how He can handle everything in between. Okay, and this is how he starts. Why are the nations in an uproar and the people devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. And let me tell you that what we have here has a dual application for us. Certainly, there is a strong prophetic application to this entire psalm, giving us a powerful picture of that point in history yet to come when the rulers of this world under the leadership of the Antichrist will literally seek to wage war against the people of God and against Christ Himself. And as we see this psalm progressing, we will see that not then and not ever are those leaders a threat to the plans and purposes of God. But there's an application of this psalm that is a whole lot closer to home. Because embedded in these opening words of this psalm is the chronic vulnerability of all those who rise to positions of human power. The vulnerability to view themselves as above the law. Power is intoxicating. And the greater the power, the more intoxicating it becomes. I had terrible history teachers all the way through high school. Most of them had been teaching way too long, and any passion they had, either for their material or for their students, had long since gone by the way. Okay, now I do realize that what I've just said to you, that looking back, it's possible that the greater problem was with me as a student and not with them as teachers. But that's what I remember. But I mention this because I consciously remember only one thing from my world history teacher in high school. It was his favorite quotation, one he repeated frequently, one that summed up his personal evaluation of the entire history of man. It was a quotation from Lord Acton, a 19th century British historian, who said, "Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely." Well, actually, that's a bit of a paraphrase of what Lord Acton really wrote. What he actually said was, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men." And David's opening comments in this second psalm make it clear that our God perfectly understands the corrupting nature of power. A corrupting force that tends to lead those who hold positions of power into the belief that they are above the laws of the land and above the moral laws of God. And this corrupting power has nothing whatsoever to do with a person's political philosophy or religious beliefs or party affiliation or anything else. It has everything to do with the corrupt nature of the flesh and what happens to the flesh when a person finds themselves in a position in which he or she feels as if their position of power frees them from having to account to anybody for their actions. And this corrupting influence of power is in no way limited to the political arena. It happens everywhere. It happens in business. Take a look at what's happened in our financial empire recently. And how much of it is a direct result of people having power, feeling they have no accountability because they had the power to do whatever they want. It happens in social organizations. It happens in financial institutions. Any place where there are positions of power. Even our religious world, and maybe I should say especially our religious world, is littered with examples of men and women who have achieved great positions of power over others and then used those positions as a covering for personal lives of immorality and corruption. But my point here is simply that whenever God talks with us about our political leaders, He assumes a measure of corruption. He assumes a measure of corruption. Even a level of corruption that brings about either private or open rejection of the Lordship of Jesus Christ in their lives. The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, "Let us tear His fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. But that isn't where the psalm ends. Not even remotely. Having given us a view through the minds of those who hold the power, David then allows us to see these men and women through the eyes of God. And what he sees changes everything. The psalm goes on. He who sits in the heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, "But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain." And of everything that happens in this psalm, this right here is what we need to hear the most. This is God's response to all those who attempt to use their positions of power to attack Jesus Christ or to diminish His lordship in the lives of His people or to subvert His predetermined plans and purposes for the nations of this world. The absurdity of their arrogance causes the Creator of all things to laugh. And in effect, David quotes God as saying, "I have already established my king, and nothing you say or do can threaten me or cause me to change my plans or purposes on this earth in the least. Nothing and no one can ever, will ever undo what I have done." From there, he then goes on to strengthen what he's just said by allowing us to listen in on a conversation between God the Father and Jesus Christ. And that's what's taking place in verses 7 through 9. "I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me," this is Jesus Christ telling us what God the Father said, "You are my Son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware." Now, isn't that nice stuff? That's God the Father granting to Jesus Christ absolute, ultimate authority over all human governments, telling him that those who do not willingly submit to his lordship will ultimately be shattered by him as a man would shatter a clay pot with a powerful blow from an iron rod. And David has at least two major purposes in writing these words. The first purpose concerns those of us who have fallen victim to the lie that God's plans and purposes on this earth are in any way dependent upon the willing cooperation of human authority. And to this, he responds by reminding us of the most basic truth of our existence. There is only one Creator God, and no created being can ever or ever will undo what He has ordained. David's second purpose in writing is to offer a closed-circuit message to all those who hold positions of power on this earth. And listen to how he ends the psalm. "Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that He not become angry and you perish in the way, for His wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in Him." Now, isn't that great? See, that's God's not so subtle reminder that no matter where we may be positioned in human society, we can never ever escape the authority of the God who created us. And every human leader faces exactly the same choice. Either choose submission to the King of Kings, or know that in His time, the King of Kings will bring them down. Which brings me to the first absolute I want to share with you this morning. The certainty of God's absolute authority over all human governmental structures. No human governmental structure and no human political leader ever has or ever will stand in the way of God's plan for the ages. Did the candidate of your choice win this past week? If your hope is in that candidate to bring about a better world or a brighter future, then your hope is misplaced. God will most certainly work through him to bring about his purposes, but God alone is worthy of our hope and our trust. Did the candidate of your choice this past week lose? Do you think that loss in any way prevents the King of Kings from fulfilling his purposes and plans in this nation and in this world? If so, then you have misunderstood your God and His absolute control over all human leaders and His absolute commitment to fulfill His purposes through them. Which brings me to the second absolute I want to share with you this morning. God's absolute commitment to work through the human governmental structures in our lives, no matter who may hold the positions within those structures. To help us here, I'll mention once again a passage which we have looked at in some detail in the past, a passage which I wholeheartedly acknowledge that none of us like, but we all desperately need to believe. This is instruction written by Paul in the context of a political system that was at times openly hostile to any who identified themselves as Christians. And yet still, this is what Paul wrote. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God. Those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. There's a whole bunch in that passage, most of which we're not going to touch on this morning. But there's one thing that I do want to point out that is embedded in this passage. It is a remarkable promise of God to His people. A promise that He will work through the governing authorities to bring about His plans and His purposes in our lives. It is a minister of God to you for good. And that commitment of God to us is in no way dependent upon which individuals hold those positions. Which brings me to my third and final absolute that I want to share with you concerning God and the kingdoms of man. Simply this: God is absolutely committed to daily, hourly, moment by moment working both in and through each of His people no matter what governmental structure we may live under, and no governmental structure, no human leader can ever alter that reality in the least. Nothing has happened this past week that has made it in any way, even a tiny bit, easier or harder for the people of God to live lives of obedient submission to Jesus Christ. Several weeks ago, we looked closely at Paul's words to us in Galatians 2:20, where he said, I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself up for me. That commitment of our God to us, His commitment to place His Spirit within us, live His life out through us, is the great absolute of our union with Him. It is never in any way, at any time, ever dependent upon anything that is happening in the society around us or in the governmental structures over us. The truth is, the vivid reality of the life of Christ within us is most visible to the world around us when it is seen against a backdrop of a culture clothed in darkness. And then to complete my comments on God and the kings of man, I'd like to read a passage. It's a long passage, but I want to take the time to read it. It was written 2,600 years ago. It is Daniel's interpretation of a dream that was given by God to Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful political ruler on the face of the earth at the time of Daniel. Okay, and this is what Daniel writes. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. You continued to look until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. And then the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell you its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand, has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom, inferior to you, and then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. And then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So, like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw that the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. In the days of those kings, the king of the heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and it will put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future, so the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. Okay, now, I've taken the time to read that passage for us this morning because I want us to see something. In that passage, written 2,600 years ago, God revealed to Daniel an overview of the political history of the human race from his time right on up until Christ establishes his kingdom on this earth. Late in the book of Daniel, Daniel saw a number of other visions that put names to those kingdoms, revealed their development and their nature and their rise and their fall in great detail. Now, why did God do that? Well, obviously, he did it in part because it was knowledge that he wanted his people to have. But there was something even more important that he wanted to communicate to us. He wanted us to know that he has known the end from the beginning. And that he and he alone is orchestrating the political framework of the human race. Actually, Daniel himself said it a whole lot better than I am. Just a few verses earlier in this second chapter of Daniel, Daniel wrote this: "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to Him. It is He who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is He who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. The kingdoms of men are a very tiny thing to the God who is, the God who created all, the God who moves all things after the counsel of His will. They are used by Him to accomplish His purposes among us, and when they have fulfilled His purposes, He sets them aside. And no human being ever has or ever will have the power to prevent the perfect unfolding of God's plans and purposes for the human race." My observations on the kingdoms of men. Let's close in prayer, shall we? Thank you, Lord. Thank you for your incredible kindness, choosing to place us in a time in history and in a nation that provides us with a wealth of freedom unlike any other peoples have ever known before. Thank you so very, very much, Lord, for a system politically so stable that we can so violently object with one another on our political perspectives, and yet, in the end, come together and move ahead the greater purposes of this nation. Thank you, Father, for the choices you made for us as a nation this past week. And thank you most of all for your absolute commitment to work through the political positions and authorities over us to accomplish your purposes on this earth and in our lives. Thank you that our security is always only you. We praise you in Christ's name. Amen.